where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As a keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me.
What Rick mentioned about the music and all the planning that went into this, so thank you, Rick, for sharing that song and for all the musicians who've participated, for Dr. Bob, who put it all together. I fear that if you hadn't been paying attention to the news, some of you might be here expecting to see Chris Oberg. I'm sorry to report that she has departed into Death Valley. She went with the young families and young adults to Death Valley camping, where 150 of them are. In thinking about the Master Planning Committee, I've remarked oftentimes that if we could just figure out how to get 150 church members every Sabbath to leave, we wouldn't have to worry about anything. This would be just the right size church. But unfortunately, we don't always manage to do that. When Chris announced her transfer or moving to La Sierra University Church, she realized that this Sabbath would be her last Sabbath. She realized this would also be the dedication of the organ, or the first Sabbath we'd have the organ here, and she also realized that roughly 250 of our members wouldn't be here. And so she decided to move her last Sabbath from this Sabbath to last week. She took her sermon title with her, and so you notice that she preached on faith and deeds last Sabbath. And she also had to find somebody to preach this Sabbath, to highlight the need for a church this size to have a professional senior pastor. And so naturally she turned to me. If any of you really need to hear Chris and missed her last Sabbath, Les Murray tells me that he has extra sermons of Chris available in the foyer, so if you wandered in here and didn't realize that she was gone, you can still pick up a copy of the CD or the DVD and listen in or watch her. Sometimes our problem is that we know the Bible too well. We know exactly how Jesus is going to respond when Mary of Bethany breaks $50,000 worth of pure nard imported from Nepal on Jesus' feet. And we know exactly what he is going to say when she scandalizes the entire town by taking down her hair and wiping his feet. And so we know that this feast that happens 6 days before Passover is going to be a dramatic turning point in Passion Week. Jesus is there in Bethany as an honored guest. He had resurrected Lazarus from the dead, and they had a dinner for him in his honor. Mary served the food. Every time we see Mary in the Gospels, she's always serving, running to do something. And Lazarus was one of the people eating with Jesus. Have you ever noticed Lazarus doesn't say a word in the Gospels? I often wonder, is that because he lived with his two sisters his entire adult life that he never ever says anything? But it's always his sisters who are doing the talking. Mary brought the pint of very expensive perfume made from pure nard. She poured the perfume on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the sweet smell from the perfume filled the whole house. And Judas had a disadvantage from us. He didn't get to read the New Testament, but he had spent the last 3.5 years going with Jesus. And he had heard Jesus say things like, "Foxes have no holes," and "Blessed are the poor," and "It's harder for a rich man to reach heaven," and "Sell everything you have and give to the poor." And so Judas had learned a few things about political correctness and what to say. He thought he knew what Jesus would say about this. And so he says, "This perfume was worth an entire year's wage. Why wasn't it sold and the money given to the poor?" You and I, as good Seventh-day Adventist Christians, are raised in a tradition that stretches back to the people who thought the Reformation didn't go far enough. We are the spiritual heirs to the Anabaptists, to the dissenters, to low church Methodists. We build practical things. We don't build giant cathedrals. We spend our money building clinics and hospitals and schools because we're practical kind of folk. And so we might very well agree with Judas's reaction. Wouldn't it have been better if all this money had been put into something of practical use? Which is why Jesus' response should surprise us, even though it doesn't, because we know it's coming. We should be taken aback when Jesus answers, "Leave her alone. It was right for her to save this perfume for today, the day for me to be prepared for burial. You will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me." Why would Jesus, who spent his whole ministry totally unaffected by materialism, who cared so deeply about the poor, the downtrodden, and the dispossessed, why should he appreciate this extravagant gift? And I pause here to mention that it was Bonnie Parker who said that I had to talk about this particular text on this particular day. She had apparently heard a sermon from Bill Lovelace a few years ago at the occasion of the dedication of the University Church organ, and she said, "If we're going to have the new organ, this is the text that goes with it." So two Fridays ago, she said, "You have to preach on this text." So here's your sermon, Bonnie. I tried my best, by the way, to crib Bill Lovelace's notes, and I couldn't get any. I actually asked for them, and he never got back to me, so apologize. So why was it that Jesus was so appreciative of this gift when everything about his ministry would suggest that this wasn't something that was very meaningful to him, all this amazing display of extravagance? I think one of the reasons why he appreciated Mary's gift is that Mary's act was in response to her seeing God act in the same extravagant way. You see, when you and I do a good deed, we are very likely to try and calculate what is the least amount of good deed I need to do to make the desired effect. So about 2 weeks ago, Sarah and I got invited to an open house for some visiting dignitaries from China. And we really didn't want to go. But she and I talked about it and decided, well, you know, we really ought to go. This is something that we should go to. And so we said, I wonder what's the least amount of time we can spend at the open house and have the desired effect. As it turned out, that particular Sabbath, we had a bunch of other things happen, and we never did get there to the open house. But, you know, you get the idea that a lot of times you and I try and calculate what is the smallest gift we can bring that might be appropriate. And that's only good stewardship, right? But Mary is different. Mary senses that God, the God that Jesus was talking to her about, the God who Jesus was, didn't think that way. Mary had heard Jesus talk about the God who was represented by the Good Samaritan. When the Good Samaritan left the wounded traveler at the inn he left it at, that he left the traveler at, was not the Motel 6. He paid for the Hilton, hotel so that he'd be comfortable. Mary understood that the God who Jesus was, when he needed to make wine for a wedding party in a village, he created an excess of wine. If you do the math about how much wine Jesus created at Capernaum, it was at least 2,500 glasses of wine. The SDA Bible commentary in response to this makes a rather laconic comment. It must have been a big wedding. I don't think so. I think it was a lot of wine. And Mary knows that when she prayed that God would heal her brother, the God that Jesus was gave her a resurrection. That's the kind of God that Jesus was portraying to Mary. And Mary, among all the disciples and followers of Jesus at the time, probably understood this better than anyone else. Mary unexpectedly found herself sitting at the feet of an extravagantly gracious God. And so she wasn't calculating the least that she could do in worship. She was celebrating and worshiping him with the most precious thing that she had. She was looking for the most she could do. And so she came upon this jar of perfume that she had not even anointed her own brother when he died shortly before. And yet she was going to pour it over Jesus because she sensed that he was moving toward his death. When you and I come in contact with something that is surprising and unexpected, just like we find God in the story, we tend to react with uncalculating joy. So I have a clip of a basketball game of Pacific Union College. The most famous basketball player that Pacific Union College has ever had is our own Pastor Dustin Combe. As a matter of fact, since he has left PUC, they have suffered losing season after losing season, and last season was so bad, not this one, but the last one was so bad, they only won one game. We have a lot of connections with the PUC basketball team. Carla Bartlett from Mesa Grande is the star of the women's basketball team, plays every minute of every game and just does amazing things up there. But this is the men's basketball team that we're going to see a clip of, and you have to realize that the men's basketball team this year, without Pastor Dustin being present, had suffered a tremendous series of last-second losses. Over and over again, Michael would call and say, yeah, we were ahead the whole game, and then at the last minute, the other team won. They had won enough games that this was their last game of the season, and whether they made the playoffs in their league depended on this. It had gone into overtime, and the score was tied 70-70 with 3.6 seconds remaining. PUC has the ball in the backcourt and is getting ready to inbound, and so we can roll the clip now. And here they go. They're starting to run the play, and number 44 over here in the end, Josh Jewett, fires up the shot from behind the half-court line, and it swishes through, and look what happens. The bench player who's jumping up and down is not Michael. That's J.P. Tan, the other freshman on the team who never gets in the game. But here's a bunch of staid, practical Adventist kids, not calculating how they look, but just totally enraptured in joy. You can look at this on YouTube, just with the sound, with all the noise and the sound, and this afternoon, just go to YouTube and search for Pacific Union College basketball, and it's Josh being carried off. If you want another example of sort of the kind of worship and joy that this represents, I don't know if you've ever noticed Dr. Philman when he plays the organ. Now, here you can't tell because we have the organ turned this way and you can't see his face. But have you ever noticed Mike when he plays the organ or the piano that in the middle of a congregational song, what's he doing? He's always singing along. And that's an example of somebody who is not calculating about what things are or how things should be or what the least is he can do. He's somebody who's totally enraptured in the music and the worship of God. And that's what it means when Mary gives her gift to Jesus. Every generation of Jesus' followers since this time has had to wrestle with the tension between what Mary represented and what Judas represented or said. Do you respond to God with the best in worship, or do we spend our resources caring for God's children? I wanted to tell you a little bit about the story of the organ. Chris took the title of the sermon. She almost took the story too, and at the last minute she remembered that I wanted to use it today, and so she very graciously did not tell it to you last Sabbath. Our old organ had been here in service for over 20 years, or about 20 years, and it was starting to have problems. It wasn't quite as good as it used to be. Modern organs have a lot better sound. I don't know if you noticed that when Mike was playing the duet, that he could now, on the new organ, use the trumpet voice and have the trumpet voice sound very similar to a trumpet. And he can have pipe organ music and all sorts of other things with the new thing. So the organists in the church had decided that we probably needed to look for a new organ. And this was a year and a half or 2 years ago. About a year and a half ago, the church board formed an organ search committee to look. And Mike and Benny and Bonnie Parker and a bunch of other people, Myron, spent a lot of time going to churches, listening to organs, doing the research needed. And they settled upon a particular model of the Rogers organ as the one that would fit our church the best. It's this model here. The cost of the model is $135,000. And the church board agreed that that sounded like something we should be interested in, but at the time we had the roof to pay for. So we told the organ committee, thank you for finding the right organ, but we have to pay for the roof. Maybe afterwards we could look at the organ. And the thought was that after a decent interval, maybe we would start another fundraising campaign and get the organ paid for and then buy it. We started raising a little bit of money among the people who were interested, had gotten $20,000 at such a time as the entire economy of the world collapsed a few months ago. You might have noticed this. And Pastor Chris and Pastor Ken and all the other associate pastors had a real burden that the church services fund, the fund that you can turn to when you need a loan or need a little bit of money to get through the month, had been going through money at a prodigious rate. And they felt very strongly that the Christmas offering this year should go and be focused on member services needs. Now, this had been something that, sort of in the back of my mind, we could use for the church organ fund. That is, wouldn't it be nice after we paid the roof that we could wait till the Christmas offering came, and we could take a portion of it, the portion that usually stays here, and maybe contribute $10,000 to the new organ and get the fundraising started. But Chris and Ken and all the associate pastors and the church committee that sets the goals for each year decided that this year we really ought to devote all of the money that stays within the church from the Christmas fund to the member services. About the same time, we learned that Rogers is going to increase the cost of the organ by 8%. And this looked like the end of the organ project as it was now. We made the decision, and in December, Mike got a phone call from Robert Tall, the Rogers dealer, and said, the organ that you're looking for, the exact same model, a used one has come available for $85,000. That's $50,000 off the list price. That's more money than we raised in the entire Christmas offering. Chris's comment to this was to her, when you follow God's leading, amazing things happen. Do you agree? That's not the end of the story, because we still had our old organ that we needed to sell. We put it on eBay. Mike got a lot of questions, but nobody bid on it. I don't think we got a single bid, right? No one bid on it. This takes us back to about 8 years ago when in seventh grade, my son Michael became friends with a girl named Stephanie. They didn't date until about 9 months ago. Then they suddenly decided to risk their best friendship and start dating. And on Christmas, we had her family out to eat with us. Stephanie goes to Inland Empire Filipino Church, which is the Adventist church in downtown Redlands. And after we're talking a little bit, and organs came up. And the Laos said, you know, our organ is on the fritz because their organ runs on vacuum tubes. If you think back, those of you who are old enough, you remember that there used to be these things called vacuum tubes that you could replace. The only problem with an organ that is based on vacuum tubes is vacuum tubes are no longer made. As a matter of fact, the thing of most value in an organ that runs on vacuum tubes are the vacuum tubes that can be salvaged and used to replace vacuum tubes in other old organs. And so they're looking for a replacement organ. And after they talked about it, our organ, our old organ, got a call to the Inland Empire Filipino Church, where it is today. Do you ever feel as though you're part of something that's much bigger, that God has plans in mind, that we are all working together and that pastors and organs are moving around for his betterment? Let's go back to Jesus' surprising response to Mary. He says, it was right for her to save this perfume for today, the day for me to be prepared for burial. We Protestants don't talk a lot about Jesus' human body. But in fact, it is this body which God came in the incarnation that is the center of God's revelation to us. Jesus' body was going to die with or without the spike, the nard. It was going to be resurrected with or without the nard. It was even predicted in the Old Testament, because you will not leave me in the grave, you will not let your Holy One see corruption, in the terms of the way we sing it in Handel's Messiah. Jesus could have said, Mary, you don't have to worry about my body. It's going to be resurrected, and you can save the spikenard. But what makes Jesus' body and his incarnation so special to all Christians is that this is the visible representation of what we understand the God in heaven to be. It is the best picture we have of what God is like, what characteristics he has. And it's the body of Jesus' impending death that loomed over this poor celebration at Bethany. And Jesus knows that this is going to draw all humanity to him. A part of the Bible that we oftentimes skip over in chapter 11 of John is the story of Caiaphas and what Caiaphas is doing as Jesus is raising Lazarus and is being anointed. In between, we have a picture that John puts in of Caiaphas plotting. It's like the evil guy's lair in Batman, where the whole TV set is tilted, so you know you're in the bad guy's house. Here is Caiaphas, and he says, you people know nothing. Don't you realize that it's better for one man to die than for the people of the whole nation to be destroyed? Caiaphas did not think of this himself. As high priest that year, he was really prophesying that Jesus would die for their nation and for God's scattered children, to bring them all together and make them one. This is the first time that John introduces a theme that is going to continue through the rest of the book of John. This idea that Jesus' death creates unity, at-one-ment, among his followers. And ironically enough, it is Jesus' enemy that first gives this voice. Jesus says himself a little bit later in the book of John, in John 17, 20, I pray for these followers, but I'm also praying for those who will believe in me because of their teaching. Father, I pray that they can be one, that they can be united. As you are in me and I am in you, I pray that they can also be one in us. Then the world will believe in me. Growing up in Sabbath school class, I was oftentimes reminded that I might be the only Christian that somebody might meet. Especially being Asian in a very Caucasian part of this country, I had it very clearly told to me by my mom, you have to behave because you are Chinese and you have to set a good example. That's a lot of pressure. And so it's an incredible relief to me to read John 17, to realize that yes, while I represent Jesus, what really represents Jesus in this world, what really is the representation of God to the world right now, is you and I together as followers of Jesus at one with each other. And that's what Jesus says in this prayer. So that you and I in this congregation are part of Jesus' body, as Paul says. And just like organs in a body, we minister to one another. So you and I are very used to the idea that a senior pastor is called here to minister to us. But just as much, and maybe even more, we as a congregation are called upon to minister to our pastors and to help them along as they minister for God. You can think of this church in particular, but any church, especially in the Seventh-day Adventist world, where we move pastors around every 5 years or so, that what we do here with our pastor, the lives we live, is preparing the pastor for their next place of service. You can think of it like being the AAA farm team for a major league team. We get them for a little while, and after they learn more, they move on to the majors, hopefully. Or a better example, really, is a teaching hospital. We take in the best residents each year, and 3 or 4 or 5 years later, we turn them out as practicing physicians, and we're grateful to have had the opportunity to do the training. Well, that's what all Adventist churches do, but maybe our church in particular more than others. We've just lost our 4th senior pastor in the past 16 years. And really, that's not a bad average. It's only 1 year shorter than the rule of thumb of 5 years, and then you have to move. But it's still always painful to lose a senior pastor, especially one that you love. And we can be grateful that we have had senior pastors who are some of the most dynamic, spiritually inclined, humble, teaching ministers that we can imagine. Our last 4 senior pastors were Mick Thurber, Clarence Schilt, Derek Morris, and Chris Oberg. They have moved on to the PUC Church, to Southwestern Adventist now for Mick, moved on to Forest Lake Academy Church, the most prominent church in the Florida Conference for Derek, and now La Sierra for Chris. Clarence moved on to an even more important call, his grandchildren in Idaho. But that's where people go when they leave Cala Mesa. And I hope we feel that we have a sense of responsibility to our brothers and sisters in other churches that we have been entrusted by God with these valuable people who we help train and teach and love and send on in their ministry to further his work. I don't know if we often appreciate the associate pastors we have here. A lot of people are feeling a little abandoned by pastors leaving. The one pastor who sticks with us through thick and thin is Ken Curtis. And I'm afraid we take Ken for granted here. Ken is... Ken is known by other theologians as somebody to turn to write commentaries. He's known nationally among his colleagues. He's known for his work with a group called The Journey, where he helps other ministers stay spiritually connected with God. And Ken, we've been privileged to have Ken's ministry here among us for, I think, as long as the old organ. And so we should be grateful for that. When Ken produces a sermon or a play that the Pathfinders put on or that the teens used to put on, He's always sneaking in little messages that are incredibly profound, deep spiritual thoughts if you listen for them. And he's very sneaky about it too. We have Isaac Kim. Isaac is one of these people who I think we all know, in addition to his love of God and his humility, is an incredibly organized person. He also is nationally known among youth ministers or young adult ministers for doing things like Cruise with a Cause. Who organizes this whole thing? It's Isaac Kim, our associate pastor. He organizes mission trips. He organizes the church. This guy, I have a feeling, is going to end up conference president or union president or maybe GC president one day. And you and I can sit back and say, we knew him when he was putting on funny costumes for kids at Cala Mesa Church. Saul Barcelo. Saul just came to us not too long ago. He's young. He's incredibly intelligent, incredibly gifted guy. Very successful in young adult ministries. And he came here to help be mentored by Chris and by us. And then that brings us to Dustin. Dustin, as you know, was a basketball player at PUC. But he was also a theology major. And when Chris told us about Dustin, she told us the conference was giving us a brand new slot, that we actually gained a slot, gained a pastoral position when Dustin came a few years ago. And he was the most sought after theology major in PUC by all the conferences. Southeastern California, our conference, had an advantage because Heidi wanted to go to school at Loma Linda. But all the conferences were fighting over this talented guy who knew media ministries, the ministry of the future. And we got him here in our church. And so when Chris was telling us this on the board and to me personally, I got to thinking, you know, it's like Dustin is a first-round draft choice. I don't know, Heidi, did you know you're married to a guy who was a first-round draft choice? But he is, and he's going to be a very cool guy to watch his career develop, too. So we have a wonderful group of pastors here who minister to us, but remember, we minister to them at the same time. Every pastor would tell us, Chris would tell us this too, that any church is not a pastor. It is the people in the church that make the church. And Jesus' body is composed of pastors, of organists, of musicians, of people who lead worship leaders. It's composed of people who set up Sabbath school rooms for kids' divisions at all hours of the day or night. It's composed of people who come tomorrow morning to count the offering and make sure that everything is receipted correctly. It's made of people who sit in the back row and just listen. It's made of people who attend Mesa Grande, who go to Sabbath school classes here. It's made up of followers of Jesus who have different talents. It's made up of followers of Jesus who look different from each other. It's even made up of followers of Jesus who understand Jesus' words very differently from one another. But what this story is telling us, and what the Gospel of John is telling us, is that when Jesus' followers can abide as one, it is then that the world can see Jesus and know that God sent him. The body of Christ that Mary anointed with spikenard 2,000 years ago is still present today in Cala Mesa. May our neighbors catch just a whiff of the aroma of Mary's extravagant act of worship, as you and I embody the good news of our extravagantly gracious God today.